From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. And today, we're starting the show in the streets of Brooklyn, New York.
So it is a chilly Friday. It's gray outside. We are not far from Prospect Park. And what's the name of the bar we're going to?
It's Irv's on Beekman.
That's my producer, Fernanda Camarena. And you heard right, we're going to a bar, not because I need a drink. I mean, I'm not opposed to it, but that's not why I'm here. I've come to meet the owner, a guy named Steve Fishman.
Right across the street here. You want to go in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Al.
Hey, man.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I figured I'd greet you from behind the bar.
Nice, nice, nice. What do you got lined up here?
Well, I got you a shot of bourbon. Obviously, that's the way you start all your interviews.
Hey. Cheers.
Good to meet you.
Steve's bar is a cozy little hangout tucked into what used to be an old laundromat in a three-story brick apartment building. The blue laundromat sign still hangs in the front. Irv's specializes in handcrafted cocktails. It has a machine that makes perfectly square ice cubes to drop into drinks. The bar is named after Steve's father, Irv, who passed away last year.
Two of these and you feel like a billionaire.
Yeah. And Steve's not pouring drinks. He's working as a journalist, a magazine writer, and a podcast maker.
A journalist owning a bar seems like a scary combination. Because every time I'm hanging out with journalists, they're drinking. I say they, like, we're drinking. How did you end up owning a bar?
Well, it's been a long time as a journalist. I actually dropped out of college and became a journalist of a small newspaper in Connecticut. The newspaper bought a bar.
Smart newspaper.
So we would go right down, because I worked the 3 to midnight shift, and then we would go right down to the bar until closing. And, you know, let's face it, you sit down with a beer or a shot and, you know, you start talking, and it's just great to hear the stories.
Steve has chased a lot of stories through the years, but I'm here to talk to him about one that's captivated him more than any other, the story of Bernie Madoff. But remember him? The New York financier who ran a Ponzi scheme that cost investors tens of billions of dollars?
Mr. Madoff, what would you say to all those people that lost money?
Hey, Bernie, just talk to her.
What would you say to them?
Go ahead. Bernie! Hey, Bernie, give me one nice shot, buddy.
Bernie duped people into trusting him with their money and then put it into fake investments and doled out fake returns. Their money made Bernie and a handful of others rich. And then the market crashed in 2008 and exposed his scam. It was one of the largest financial frauds in U.S. history, with accounts that Bernie claimed were worth more than $60 billion. It was a lie, and when the bottom dropped out, it raised big questions about the safety of investments. And even though Bernie Madoff is a fading memory for most Americans, Steve says his story has lessons for us today.
We are now living in an era that very markedly proclaims itself to be not only pro-business, but anti-regulation. It's an administration that really lives on and offers us the proposition that business, banks, finance does not need to be regulated. It needs to be unregulated. And to my mind, that's exactly what led to somebody like Madoff.
Wall Street analysts say President Trump's new tax law could add fuel to an already hot stock market. Today's market run is even stronger than the one that led up to the Great Recession. Steve remembers the market crash and the day he first heard about Bernie.
Bernie gets arrested. It's headlines. My editor comes over to me and says, you know, this might be a story for us. Let's wait and see if it lasts the weekend. And I kind of plunged into it. It was great journalistic sport. You know, everybody in the world was after Bernie. And I thought, you know, I got to find this guy. He's the poster boy for the financial crisis. And I'm thinking, if I understand Bernie, I'm going to understand the financial crisis.
Unlike pretty much everyone else who covered Bernie, Steve stuck with the story long after it disappeared from headlines. He produced a podcast series for Audible on Madoff's scam called Ponzi Supernova. Steve wanted to understand, really understand, how Bernie got away with his scheme and what made him tick as a person. He talked to investors, he tracked down regulators and people who knew him. And he was determined to talk to Bernie himself, who's serving a 150-year sentence in a federal prison in Butner, North Carolina. After Bernie got locked up, he refused to talk to the media. Steve's strategy was to get to Bernie by connecting with people who had access to him, his prison mates.
Here's a hilarious thing. So Bernie's like a superhero to them. I mean, a supervillain to us, a superhero to them.
A superhero, a super criminal hero. You know what I mean?
This is Casey White, a bank robber who was the first prison mate of Bernie's who Steve connected with.
He had been in prison with Bernie. He's got an afro, a really lovely smile, not a whole lot of teeth in that smile, but a really friendly guy, a great storyteller.
Because this is a man that done stole more money than anybody else. We're talking about anybody else? One old man done took everybody? He done beat the record on everybody. He done went to the top of the list in criminality. Everybody's in there for money. The majority of the cases is about money. You know what I mean? And here you got a man that done did it, done took it all. He's more important than Jesse James. You know what I mean? Bonnie and Clyde.
KC knew inmates who were still behind bars with Bernie. He'd smuggled a list of them out of the prison and gave it to Steve.
Now, for me, these were the people who could get me to Bernie. So I take that list and I write to all 150 people on that list. But the real break for me comes that because there's this guy in prison named Robert Rosso. And Robert Rosso comes upon one of my letters. And he reaches out to me.
I mean, it was nice for me that you were a writer. I'm sure it was nice for you that I was a writer.
Yeah.
Robert became a writer in prison while serving a life sentence for dealing meth. Steve and Robert bonded, and one day Steve sent Robert a letter asking him to hand it to Bernie.
So I did, and I said you wanted to talk to him. And he said, I don't really want to talk to anybody. And he kind of walked off a little bit. He stopped, and he said, Rob, he goes, what do you think of him? And I said, I like him. That's what I said. I go, I like him. Said, he seems like a straight shooter. And he goes, okay. He goes, okay. He goes, let me go take a look and read this.
And then, one evening, back in January of 2011.
My home phone rings. It's an evening. The Jets are in the playoffs. I remember that. And I get this recorded voice. You have a collect call from Bernard Madoff. I've been trying to get to this guy for like 2 years, right? And there he is on the phone. In the background, my kids are shouting and screaming. My reaction, shut up, it's Bernie Madoff on the phone. And here's the strange thing about the phone call from Bernie. It's like a guy I could meet at a bar mitzvah. I mean, this guy, we're both from the New York area. I recognize the accent. I probably have a similar accent.
Calls from this prison are cut off after 15 minutes, and Steve couldn't move fast enough to record that first one. But then Bernie calls back.
You have a PAC direct call from Bernard Madoff.
Bernie?
Yeah, hi, Steve.
Hi. Well, I was just saying it was great to talk to you because, you know, talking to you in person is so different than reading about you, all the kind of caricature out there and the whole sense of you as being, you know, just this one-dimensional person.
And it was nice talking to you too, Steve.
Yeah, that's so, right.
So I'm immediately comfortable, you know, and I think Bernie's comfortable too. I mean, that was Bernie's gift, you know. He was comfortable with everybody and instilled confidence in everybody. So maybe this is just Bernie being Bernie, but, you know, we have this kind of rapport, and it leads into a very easy conversation. But I have to tell you, the thing that was stunning to me, Bernie wants to talk.
He sounds okay on the phone. Trust me, I'm not okay.
I was under tremendous pressure. It was an absolute, it was a nightmare, only for me.
Yeah. So
it was only a nightmare for me.
I guess you kind of knew it would end up here, you know, where you are now, sooner or later.
Yes, when I say nightmare, that's a nightmare. Imagine not being able to tell anybody. I destroyed the family. They said, why did you need to do this? And I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I try and figure out here once a week.
Yeah.
The psychologist.
Yeah.
Place. And they, unfortunately, they have wonderful psychologists here. And they're very helpful to me.
Wow, that's great.
Believe me.
That's great.
I have tearful sessions with her every week.
The prison where Bernie is serving his sentence is known for having great medical facilities, and that includes therapy for inmates. It's listed by Forbes as one of America's 10 cushiest prisons. Steve became Bernie's first interview with the media since landing there, but it wasn't a standard Q&A. Steve almost became like a second therapist for Bernie, who opened up about his life. He talked about his father.
My father built a sporting goods business. He owned a company called Dodger Sporting Goods, and they had a big successful business. And then during the Korean War, there was a steel shortage. He couldn't get steel, and his business failed. So, you know, I lived through that. You watch that happen, and you see your father, who you idolize, you know, build a big business and then lose everything. You're frightened about, you know, about something like that happening.
And he talked about the Ponzi scheme.
You know, Bernie said to me, if you think I woke up one day and decided to steal everybody's money, you're wrong. I didn't need it.
If you think that I did this, I woke up one morning and said, well, listen, I want to be able to buy a boat and a plane, and this is what I'm going to do, that's wrong. I had more than enough money to support any of my lifestyle and my family's lifestyle. I didn't need to do this for that.
Bernie already had a legitimate stock trading business, and he was a former chair of NASDAQ. So he wasn't hurting for money, but he started the scam anyway. And once he got started, he couldn't stop.
It feeds your ego. I mean, you know, you say to yourself, all right, all of a sudden these banks, which wouldn't give you the time of day, some of them all of a sudden are willing to give you $1 billion. I had all of these major banks coming down and entertaining me. It is a head trip.
In some of those conversations, Bernie sounds like a confident master manipulator. At other times, like people are taking advantage of him.
Everybody was greedy. Everybody wanted to go on, and I just went along with it.
And he talked about the day his scheme came crashing down, December 10th, 2008. He had to come clean to his two sons. He says they didn't have a clue.
And then my brother came in, and he said, well, you know, you have to tell the boys. They know something's wrong. They don't know what it is. So we got into my car, and we drove a few blocks to the apartment. Boy, Ruth was home.
Nice.
We had my Christmas party that night. That's when I broke down, and I told them, started crying, and I explained to him what the deal was. I owe all this money out, and I'm not going to be able to recover it.
And nobody gets angry at that point.
Everybody was stunned. They were shocked. I mean, they were scared, and they were shocked.
Right.
You know, I mean, look, in this picture, one day you think your father's running this multi-billion-dollar business, and everything is fine, and he's happy, and they're happy, and then all of a sudden, the world comes crashing down. They saw me in tears. The last time I cried like that was in the same mold, and I found out my son had cancer. The afternoon I told them all, they immediately left. They went to a lawyer. The lawyer said, you got to turn your father in. They went, did that, and then I never saw them again.
The family would never recover. On the two-year anniversary of his father's arrest, Mark Madoff committed suicide, hanging himself in his Soho loft. Later, Bernie's youngest son, Andrew, died of cancer. Andrew blamed the return of the disease on his father's crime.
Do you think Bernie expected his children to turn him in?
You know, I don't know if he expected it, but he tells it as a moving story. There are a lot of people who won't be moved by it. I will say this about Bernie. I kind of believe Bernie got, like, bone tired. He just couldn't support the lie anymore. But there was something about him that was relieved to finally see it end.
Steve learned a lot about Bernie during their string of 15-minute phone calls. They spoke around a dozen times, and then prison officials cut them off. But that didn't stop Steve from piecing together the story of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme and how he was able to fool financial regulators and thousands of investors for years. That's coming up on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.